Matthew 18, 21 through 35. Then Peter came and said to him, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, not seven times, but I tell you 77 times. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. And as he could not pay, his Lord ordered him to be sold together with his wife and children and all his possessions in payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, have patience with me and I will pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But the same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him by the throat, he said, pay what you owe. Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, have patience with me, I will pay you. But he refused. Then he went, threw him into prison until he would pay his debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their Lord all that had taken place. Then his Lord summoned him and said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all the debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you? Father, we thank you for this morning and this time to be together. And Lord, we pray now that our hearts and minds are open, that your Spirit work in us and transform us more into your image. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. So Peter asks a question in verse 21 and says, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? And on the heels of this discussion that Jesus just had in verses 15 through 20, where Jesus talks about accountability with one another, Peter asks a question that maybe you and I probably would be thinking as well. When is enough enough? I mean, who hasn't been there with someone before? It's not as if Peter is asking anything unreasonable of this discussion that Jesus is having. And if you look at Peter's response, and you got to like that, Peter responds to his own. He answers his question. What Peter says doesn't seem too excessive. I mean, for some of us, Peter's solution might be excessive. And make no mistake, Peter's proposal is generous toward the offending party. And again, some of us might say too generous. I mean, I was trying to remember how the saying goes, and forgive me for watching President Bush try to do it, but fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So seven times forgiving someone might seem and feel a bit excessive for us. I mean, forgiveness once, okay. I think most of us can understand that call on our lives as we try to follow in this way of Jesus. But there has to be an accountability at some point, right? There has to be an accountability for someone's actions. There must be punishment or payment for one's wrongdoing. So when Peter brings us seven times for forgiveness, while excessive, at least there's a limit. Most of us in here can count to seven. We can do that. So there's an end point to this. It's as if Peter is saying, I can at least create my own mental blackboard, and I can keep tally of the wrongs from every person. So I can keep a mental blackboard with you and say, okay, that's three. Four more, and I'm done with you. And I think we get that because who hasn't done that to somebody before? Who hasn't looked at someone and the first thing that came up was the wrongs that they've done to you, right? We immediately look at the wrongs and say, this is how many times they've done it to us. And so this week I was reading an article and it was entitled, Time to Let Go, Why Grudges Hurt Us More Than Them. The author speaks to the central role that grudges and out of grudges vengeance plays a central role in most of the things that we read, especially most of the novels that we read, especially for those who really care about reading 19th century classics. You know, works written by Charles Dickens, Alexander Dumas, Herman Melville, George Eliot. Many of these works all talk about grudges. The main plot is about a grudge that someone is holding and they can't let it go, and it eats them up and it envelops them. And in fact, one of my favorite books, The Count of Monte Cristo, if you haven't read the book, I know you've probably seen the movie. But The Count of Monte Cristo was fueled by a character's desire for vengeance based on everything that they've done to them. It's about a grudge. And in that grudge towards all of these people, he must get back with them. And I was reminded of a favorite quote of mine from The Count of Monte Cristo. And it says this: "Hatred is blind. Rage carries you away. And he who pours out vengeance runs the risk of tasting a bitter draught." The whole idea of what rage and hatred and how it becomes vengeance does more to you than it does to someone else. Which brings us back to the text of Matthew 18. Jesus' response to Peter is even more remarkable than Peter's excessive answer. Because Peter's already excessive enough, 7 times. And some believe that Jesus' response, and here's a shout out to Marcus's class on Genesis, but many people think that Jesus' response here is an echo back to Lamech's curse of Genesis 4. And if you don't know Genesis 4, this is it. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, "Hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. It's almost as if Jesus, in this response to Peter, is turning the call of violence and vengeance on its head. As one writer writes, it's a complete renunciation of vengeance. Where Lamech, in the story of the Jews and the story of the history of the world, says, vengeance can be 77-fold. Jesus now says, not just 7 times, but 77 times. It's almost as if Peter quite didn't understand this forgiveness thing. And as much as I think all of us want to think that we understand this forgiveness thing, and when we read Matthew 18:22, we like to just look at it and go, yeah, that's a Jesusism. I mean, really? 77 times, whatever that means. I mean, is he really being honest here? That's difficult. I mean, Jesus, I'm better at keeping score. Now, if you want to do 77 times, I'm going to struggle. And I think Jesus is saying that's the point. But in any case, us like Peter, I think, missed what Jesus is talking about here. What is Jesus talking about when it comes to forgiveness and vengeance? And so Jesus does what Jesus does. He tells a story in his best way possible to the people around him, to Peter and those around him. He tells a story that they would understand, to kind of get what's going on here. And in the story, Jesus tells of a Gentile king. Many of us want to think this king is Jesus. Not probably so. This is just a Gentile king, because the Gentile king will be acting out of some place that is not normal for a Gentile king to react. So this Gentile king is reconciling his accounting book, and a particular slave owes him 10,000 talents. Now, here's something to understand about 10,000 talents. A talent would have represented the wages of a blue-collar worker for 15 years. So a talent would be 15 years of work. So a single talent equaling 15 years of salary, 10,000 talents, was a sum that was equal to the highest measurement of accounting in the first century. So imagine Jesus saying, Jerry Jones was deciding to take account for all of his things owed to him. And so Jerry Jones looks at his accounts and says, in my son's words, someone owes $1 zillion to me. Whatever a zillion is. And so this is what Jesus is saying. Imagine someone, yourself, owes Jerry Jones as much as you can possibly owe, and you can't pay him back. There's nothing you can do. It's a lot of money. And generally, if someone owes a lot of money, as we read in this, payment will be exacted. In Matthew 18:25, it says that. The Lord, reconciling his books, began to decide, if he can't pay it back, then I'll sell the children, I'll sell the wife, I'll sell the possessions, and I'll get what I can get for him. So payment will be exacted. When someone does something to us, when someone hurts us, when someone says something about us, payment will be exacted. And yet when we read the story, we're surprised by the story because the Gentile kings don't act this way. And the king, instead of taking his pound of flesh, selling the slave and his kids, does something different. He offers mercy. He offers forgiveness. It's an astounding moment, isn't it? It's as if Jerry Jones got on the phone with you and says, "You owe me nothing. I'll just don't worry about it." It's a reversal of fortune. And in forgiveness, instead of vengeance, happens within a first century, which is an incredibly vengeful world. It's a vengeful world. And as I was reading the text for this week, I couldn't help but be shocked by, as I was looking at it and studying it and thinking about it and thinking about what's happening on Tuesday, which is Election Day, thinking about what we've been through in the last 2.5 years with COVID, I feel like we've become a very vengeful world, folks. I feel like we've become a very vengeful people towards others. We'd rather say a hurting word than a forgiving word. We'd rather yell at somebody instead of listen to somebody. We'd rather point fingers and put them in a certain group. So instead, what we do is when someone says something, we yell at them. We yell back. Because whoever yells louder wins. And yet Jesus here doesn't seem to say, whoever yells louder wins. Jesus here seems to say, it's not about you and your vengeance and how you can get back and how you can own somebody. I think we need to hear it. I think we need to hear it. What's more shocking than forgiveness is how the slave reacts. Because this is how I think we react most of the time. And maybe this is where we see the power of a vengeance and what it can do to a person. But as the slave leaves the king's presence, he runs into an old buddy of his, a buddy who owes him a very small amount of money in comparison to what he owed. In fact, he probably owed about 100 days' wage. It was actually an amount that could be paid back. However, we can't help but notice how the slave reacts, how the forgiven slave reacts. It is the antithesis to what the Gentile king was doing. He sees his buddy who owes him some money, grabs him by the throat, throws him in debtor's prison, which, by the way, he's never going to pay it back in debtor's prison, but he throws him in debtor's prison. Whatever happened with the king has been forgotten in the instant he encounters his fellow slave. He immediately sees red and is consumed by the other person's transgression against him. However long he has been waiting for payment, that's a thing of the past. In the moment, his vengeance and his grudge towards the slave's non-payment is the focus. And so forgiveness, mercy, and grace are trumped by the grudge which leads to vengeance. The forgiven slave has become the forgotten slave because he's forgotten everything that just happened to him. His story of forgiveness, what has happened to him, is nothing more than a memory. And by the way, how quickly our memory fails when it was just 5 minutes earlier. How quickly we forget and immediately look across and see someone who said something to us and we see red. A lucky moment for the slave has turned into an unlucky moment for the one he runs into. And so what the king has started, by the way, what the Gentile king has started, something that doesn't make sense in the first century world, what the king has started with mercy and forgiveness toward the slave has now been blunted, has now been forgotten. The king was attempting, trying to change how the world works towards one another. The king exchanges ruthless judgment with its manifestations of pain and torture and shame. All of that, the king was trying to change and transform our world from that into one of forgiveness and grace. And so the story of Matthew 18 from Jesus to Peter and also to the disciples embodies a world in which I believe Jesus was pushing for, where forgiven sinners Remember that they are forgiven. Instead of a world where there's a demand for our pound of flesh when anything is wronged of us. A world that demands that we get ours from somebody else and we own them and we show them. It's as if Jesus is trying to say that's no longer the norm now that I'm in the world. And what Jesus illustrates in the parable of the forgetful sinner is a world fashioned in the image of something other than Jesus. And as Daniel Price put it, and I like how he puts it, he says this, as we judge and demand payment from one another, we fashion a world not only skeptical of forgiveness, grace, and mercy, but also downright opposed to it. Jesus is telling us a story about what happens when forgetful sinners demand justice. So here's the thing. Forgiveness in some transactional world, you know, as long as you're nice to me, I'm nice to you. If you've forgiven me, then I'll forgive you. Forgiveness in some form of transactional world leads us to believe that we actually have control over the situation. We can hold on to our forgiveness and mercy, only letting it go when certain individuals deserve it. Even when the type of forgiveness Peter is speaking of, when we read the type of forgiveness that Peter is speaking of, it is a mercy and a forgiveness based on a transaction, based on a condition. You get 7 times and that's it. The 8th time, I want nothing to do you. And this is when we get to the real sticky part of the story. The world fashioned by Peter in 1821, 7 times in the parable, is a world that forgets its own mercy and forgiveness. It forgets the very thing that sustains us each day of our lives is the mercy and forgiveness of God. Our faith is sustained by grace and forgiveness. It is food. Literal food. You just took it. It's the Lord's Supper. It is the very center for our soul. It points us toward the kingdom. And that's the problem is we'll take this food, we'll take the sustenance for ourselves, but we'll walk out of here as forgetful people. Like the unforgiving servant, how quickly we forget that each of us receives forgiveness each and every day. And instead of living into the forgiveness and mercy, because let's be honest, the very breath that you take and the life that you live is a gift, we'll walk out of here and we'll remember the pettiness of somebody else. We'll remember the pettiness of a wrong by another person. And it's partly because it's our own selfish desires. We're still intent on having our world the way that we want it. We get to decide who gets it and who doesn't. And it's always funny how we get to decide who gets it and who doesn't. Because have you ever realized that we always believe that we deserve it? You and I always believe that we deserve forgiveness. We always believe that we deserve grace. The problem is we deserve it, but nobody else deserves it. Nobody else deserves it. And I wonder who you're holding close to you right now, who you are not letting go of, who you think still doesn't deserve forgiveness. We all have them. I have them. I have people that I see on a daily basis, people I talk to that I look at, and it's struggle. And there's a struggle inside of me to be able to let go of that one thing. It's amazing how the grudge ends up controlling you more than it controls the other person. What happens is in all this, it's an environment of distrust. It causes us to create a world opposed to any idea of forgiveness and mercy. Why? Because forgiveness and mercy look weak. Because a world created on grudges and vengeance is an enemy to the people of faith. And I need you to hear that. Any grudge and any vengeance you hold right now is an enemy to your faith. It's an enemy to the world that God is creating. It is an enemy to the world that you have decided is a good world that Jesus says is a good world, and you're the ones to create it. Grudges and vengeance, they take away from that world, and it becomes an enemy to it. So our part in all of this, as ones who've received forgiveness and grace, as ones who've received forgiveness and mercy, is to remember. We are the people who remember where we once were and where we are today. Forgiveness and mercy are the power to break the cycle that has been created by vengeance and grudges. Forgiveness, get this, is freedom. We are freed from the viciousness of our own mistrust. We are freed from the very thing that grudges do, which is hold us prisoner. I heard a good quote the other day. To forgive is to set a prisoner free, only to discover that the prisoner was you. And so if we think about our life, if we think about what we've done, if we think about all the stuff that happens, if we think about how this idea of not forgiving has a way of sucking the joy out of our life, it has a way of like taking all the oxygen out of the room. And if we think about our own week and then in this next week, we can think about the things that are going to happen to us, and there are going to be moments that you're going to be able to have animosity towards somebody. Most of us in here are at some point going to drive down South Lake Boulevard. And someone's going to cut you off. And we're going to lay on the horn. You might even speed up and get right next to him and stare at him, because that'll show him. You might even think a bad thought towards that individual. And then you might brood on that the entire rest of the day, thinking that person meant to do that to you. They had been waiting in the morning and said, "Do not worry. Russell Friends will be driving down here at 3:45, and I'm going to cut him off. I'll show him." You're going to have those moments. You're going to have a moment this week when a friend or coworker is going to say something to you, is going to say something that will be misconstrued by you as a demeaning or in an insult. And what's going to happen is a friend's going to ignore you in the hallway. I don't know. They're not going to call you back. They're not going to text you back. Lord, that's me most of the time. But they're not going to, by the way, don't take it wrong. But they're going to do something in which it's going to happen to you. You're going to ask them to do something in a timely manner, and they're not going to do it on a timely manner because they're not working on your timetable. Any of these things in this next week will have a way of sitting with you, will have a way of making you have to decide how you're going to react in the moment. Tuesday's going to happen, folks. You're going to have to decide how to react. You're going to have to decide how to talk to people about it. And you're going to have to decide how you listen to people about it. And you're going to have to decide if that person who votes differently you is really your enemy. And you're going to have to decide if that person who votes different than you can still be your friend. Or are you just going to let it sit to them? You're going to let it sit in you and become a rage and hatred. The world fashioned by Peter's answer to his own question about forgiveness means there are conditions to the world. It's a three strikes and you're out mentality. And it works great for baseball, although we can all be sad Houston won the World Series. It works great for baseball. But as we read with the parable, it makes for a harsh world. It makes for a harsh world for all, especially for sinners. And there's nothing easy about what Jesus says. And folks, this is not easy Christianity forgiveness. This is next level stuff. Peter was easy Christianity. Peter was simple. Take names, put tick marks by them. When they get to a certain spot, done with them. Jesus says, nah. To follow me in the world I'm creating is to live into an advanced idea. An idea that everyone deserves mercy. That everyone deserves forgiveness. That each time that you offer mercy and forgiveness in that little piece of the world that you're in that moment, you're claiming it for Jesus. And so being an individual and community that should be practicing mercy and forgiveness does not mean that we don't hold one another accountable. But what it does mean is that the two things, accountability and forgiveness, are held in tension with one another. It is not an either or, but a both and. Forgiveness mediates accountability, steering it away from retribution and vengeance, because we see in our own lives the verdict that we've all received in Jesus. Forgiveness ought to produce forgiveness in us. Mercy ought to produce mercy in us. And therefore, we are a group of people who constantly and always practice radical, no limited forgiveness. And that's your call today. Who are you holding close that you need to forgive? Who are you holding close that you haven't forgiven? Who are you holding close that you still believe doesn't deserve mercy? Because there's that last part of that text that's really hard. And Jesus says it a few times. If you can't forgive, then God struggles with forgiveness for you. And partly I think it's because if we can't forgive, we're holding it so close and so deep into our heart that we're not going to believe that God can even forgive us. And so it's already done its thing to us. What freedom do you need to let go of something someone's done to you? What freedom do you need to be able to see people in a way? And I like this as we close. Frederick Buechner said this. He said, when we forgive, we allow ourselves and the person to once again be able to live in their own skin. And therefore with the hopes of reconciliation between the two. If you have any needs this morning, we'll have elders up front, I'll be up front, but come now as we stand and as we sing.